I mean, Johnson's head does deserve to go, but there isn't any other head at the moment which is actually standing up for the truth. I mean, all the other heads that are wagging about are basically talking inside the permitted parameters of what's allowed, what discussion's allowed, and that is what is the problem. So, the whole thing is just a big sort of controlled narrative, distraction for the masses. And again, the whole process of divide and rule. And we need to go above that and actually, squash all of that nonsense and get to the actual bottom of what's going on.
Yeah, so what is going on?
Well, what's going on is that more and more professionals are actually braving the onslaught of attack, which seems to be, what's been going on for the last 2 years of coming to an absolute crescendo. Anybody previously who ever stuck their neck out experienced this, but because they were standing alone, they didn't get much attention and got completely brushed under the carpet, and very few people were aware of it. But now, because it's on such a massive scale, it's harder and harder to actually, brush these people aside. So more and more professionals are coming out. They it's taken them a long time. There were a few brave souls who stuck their necks out very early on in this whole scamdemic. People like Matt, I mean, mostly people who'd retired already, like Mike Eden and Sucharit Bhakdi, and
Yeah, there is the
the
likes of
executive.
Eric Clapton and Van Morrison as well in the artistic world, which didn't really seem to get much attention at all, considering their status.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's beginning now. I mean, it's just like if you imagine it's a carpet, everything's been swept under the carpet, then there'd be the size of an elephant under the carpet. I mean, it's just ridiculous now. It's bursting at the seams, the number of people who are already, you have Dr. Sam White, you have an endless number of professionals now who are simply in the UK, in the US, in Canada, in, wherever, who are just as completely astounded that this has actually got to this stage. And because now they actually realize that their lives are under threat now, that their livelihoods are under threat, and that it's not just good enough to have two jabs, they've got to have, the repeated rollout of boosters. They're finally deciding this is their red line now. It's come to the point where I've been waiting for this red line. I've been waiting for people to reach the point of their red line where they wouldn't cross beyond it. And I thought it came, for me, it came over a year ago, 18 months ago. I was thinking, God damn it, where's the red line for everybody? And finally, it's getting to the point where increasing numbers of people have said, we are not crossing this red line, and that's that. So the governments, across NATO, across EU, US, UK, Canada, they're literally just grabbing at straws now to kind of stuff the news media full of nonsense news in order to keep people away from what's actually.
Well, yeah, but hang on, because last Saturday, the 22nd of January, 2022, there were massive demonstrations right across the country. We had something here in Bristol. All major cities had some sort of demonstration. London, an enormous one with many thousands of people. And these are part of a campaign which it's obviously not just the workers themselves. NHS 100K. Which is the 100,000 people working at, in they believe in the NHS, who are about to lose their jobs because they haven't had a vaccination, or they call it a vaccination. You probably much better, and they call it a jab. And it's not just one jab; it's two jabs, and then possibly three or four or five. And this is a been, you know, this is I think the most amazing thing is that it got virtually zero coverage anywhere and a little bit here and there, but certainly no major coverage in the news media, even though this is possibly going to destroy the National Health Service.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't a surprise really that it wasn't covered. I mean, the Daily Mail did cover it. They've been covering it, these massive protests, quite, I would say, fairly well, of course, but they still use the term anti-vaxxer, and they try and, you know, they refer to people like Piers Corbyn as, you know, notorious anti-vaxxer and so on, things like that. And so they use kind of very inflammatory type of language. But they have a lot of photos in their spread, and they generally do sort of report both sides, but it's very slanted in the language that they use. But yeah, I mean, I don't know whether the BBC covered it or anything, but there were massive protests in Belgium, which, you know, in Brussels, and the seat of the EU Parliament and so on. And just really, you know, I mean, the same thing has happened over and over. We've had close to, some say, over a million protesters in previous protests, you know, which, again, were not covered in the mainstream because they've been paid. They're bought out. You know, they are in receipt of millions of pounds of government funding in the form of advertising and in informative sort of propaganda pieces. And so they're not going to cover it. And so that, once again, they're the last. They're going to be the last to cover this.
Anyone that's interested in following what's happening with NHS 100K, their website's nhs100k.com. But you know, you're quite right. The Mail did cover it quite extensively and quite well, but very, very little, if anything at all, on the main news bulletins on Saturday. I was listening out, and you know, I'm thinking, well, hang on, I can see all this on social media, but the BBC newsroom just don't seem to have noticed it.
Yeah, well, it's quite plain, you know, it's quite clear that they've lost credibility amongst a vast swathe of the British public. There was a placard apparently that asked whether the BBC had lost its credibility with COVID or from COVID or something like that. I mean, it was a play on the way they define who dies with COVID. Yeah, I mean, it's so blatant. It's sad that there are still people who tune in, you know, seem to have access to things like, you know, the five channels on TV and the various mainstream radio.
Well, I think the answer to that one is that simply that because people actually want to be reassured and comforted rather than informed.
Well, yeah, there may be aspects to that. But for example, if I just use my dad as an example, he's a well-educated person, but, you know, he doesn't have any social media presence. You know, he's a technophobe. He doesn't use, I mean, when he used to go online, he would always go to the Guardian website to read what the Guardian was posting. He listens to BBC Radio 4. He watches Channel 4 News, ITV and BBC News. You know, he thought he was being a little bit risque by watching Al Jazeera or, you know, RT. But even they're pretty much towing the line. So, you know, when I try and point out and send him links and things to other stuff, because it hasn't got the stamp of approval, or perhaps because it actually is quite a weighty document, you know, with lots of technical terminology, he doesn't want to wade through all that. So I think there's a lot of people who still expect the BBC or Channel 4 or Radio 4 or whatever to kind of pass the information down into manageable, understandable size, bite-sized pieces that they can then absorb. And it's not really working like that. It's definitely not working like that, because they're, what they're doing is passing down government, behavioral management and behavioral psychology and propaganda from government, and just literally churning it out day after day. It's hard to reach people like that who are in that, sector of society.
I think maybe the best, certainly the way I think it has emerged as the best way is just simply to, rather than to sort of try and browbeat people, is simply to ask them to check a few basic facts about, have you seen the difference between the official numbers of people who have, this is a bit of a gift, last week, I think it was, or a couple of weeks ago, with this Freedom of Information request, come out with the actually tiny number of people who actually died of COVID with, who didn't have some sort of other underlying health condition, the actual people who are dying of COVID rather than with COVID is tiny, for example, this sort of thing. Just encouraging people to use their ability to research things a little bit for themselves.
Yeah, well, I have tried that. I think, for a certain generation of people, certainly for my dad, who's now pushing 80, his kind of mentality now is that he just wants to get on with the last few years of his life. And the scale of this lie is so enormous. It really shakes, I think, people to the very foundations. And if they haven't contemplated much of what they have been taught and learned over the years may not actually be 100% true, and that there was definitely levels of propaganda woven throughout and a lot of misdirection and so on, it's just too much to get your head around. And this is the culmination, I think, for a lot of people who, if they've only just come to the true realization that we've been lied to on such a massive scale, that it's just too much to get their head around. So I think they will only gradually be able to see when, the mainstream media starts to talk a little bit about, well, actually, the vaccines aren't working as we thought, and yes, they might actually be slightly harmful to some people. And on the long run, it looks like natural immunity is probably best. And this sort of thing. And then, I think the government is in a panic. But we haven't won. We are nowhere near winning this yet. We've got to keep pushing and keep pushing, because at the very best, what they'll do is try and blag it like they did the Iraq war and say, well, this is what, like they did in the Iraq war, saying that that's what intelligence, was telling them, and they didn't know. I mean, it was all absolute nonsense what they claimed, because they knew full well, just as they know full well now that what they're doing is criminal, and there's no scientific basis for it whatsoever.
Yeah, they seem to have convinced themselves that they are going to be able to get away with it, having covered the various bases of people that might investigate them, like, the Cressida Dick at the Met Police. It's funny because we've had all these calls for Boris to resign. I seem to remember about 6 or 8 months ago, everyone calling for Cressida Dick to resign, and that was simply over the fact that some of her senior officers were rapists and murderers. And I don't think, to me, it's absolutely unbelievable that a chief Met commissioner can stay in their job when that sort of thing is exposed. But no, we're being told that Boris has got to go over a piece of cake and a part, you know, a so-called party, which is taking place at work. I mean, my own opinion of this is that this is, you know, this is taking place within the work environment and the rules apply as to the work. But, you know, anyway, so it's quite obviously a massive media campaign, part of a coordinated effort to get Boris out. Anyway, look, we've got more important things to talk about than what the mass media waffle on about. I just call it the fusspot of the week story, because they seem to go on every week about something which doesn't really mean anything. This week, last couple of weeks, actually, it's been Putin about to invade Ukraine, which is a lie, and that Boris has got to go, which is also a lie. So, you know, one does wonder quite what the media's there for. You know, we had the whole thing in the early, was it 2010-ish, when about getting rid of Gaddafi. Gaddafi's got to go. We get this thing every once in a while on the mass media, don't we? And Gaddafi eventually was pole axed by a mob, and everyone is supposed to celebrate that. And the country's now being run by a bunch of warlords and gangsters, and they're desperately trying to pull it all back together, but it's a absolute hellhole. And then we had a little while after, we had Assad has got to go, and it's just now it's coming home, it seems. Anyway, look, you've got some info, I know, on the quality control at the jab factories, Catherine, which is much more important than this, I think.
Yeah, well, it was recently I saw this report. It was shared by Mike Eden, so he states as a part of the attachment that he shared, an expert report by a friend with much experience in manufacturing controls in complex pharmaceutical products. It's utterly damning. Please share. It demonstrates that what we've been told is not plausible. No wonder these quote-unquote vaccines are all over the place. Best wishes, Mike. So the document that he shares is one which was submitted to the lawyers, PHJ or PJH, I think, the law firm that are collecting evidence, in which this criminal case number by the former police constable Mark Sexton and others have, allegedly was submitted to the Hammersmith police station. I think that's where they submitted it. So this is an expert report that was prepared by a chap called Hedley Rees, who is the managing consultant at a company called PharmaFlow Limited. In the document, it gives all his CV. He's got quite a good detailed CV where he lists, you know, all the jobs he's done and what he's responsible for. Basically, his company specializes in supply chain management within the pharmaceutical and life science sectors. So he's worked with companies like Bayer and other biotech companies. And it's a very detailed report on his analysis of the way that basically all of the COVID-19 vaccines that are being used in the UK and in the EU, but specifically in the UK, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, and Pfizer or Comirnaty. He's specifically referring to them and their manufacturing and distribution methods. And basically, you know, he's just appalled by the way these things have, they've actually been given any sort of authority. he states in the document that MHRA, the British Medicines Healthcare Regulatory Authority, took on the role of authorizing new medicines into the market following Brexit, because previously it had been done by the EMA, European Medicines Agency. He actually suggests that the MHRA in the UK doesn't have suitably qualified individuals, and that they didn't take on board following Brexit suitably qualified individuals who can assess new medicine, new drugs and so on. He lists at the end of the document the people who are employed by MHRA, and it's quite clear that it doesn't appear to be anybody who is really qualified to be dealing with this sort of thing. Basically, he goes through, he explains how the routine new drug authorization or manufacturing process should happen. He says the development of new medicines take many years. We know that. On average, it takes 11.5 years for a new medicine to progress from drug discovery to preclinical testing, through clinical trials and regulatory review, onto approval. But biologics and drugs like the SARS-CoV-2 injections are actually known as advanced therapy medicinal products. That's a new term. I wasn't aware of that. Advanced therapy medicinal products, ATMPs, require the most rigorous approval of all, because ATMPs are drugs or products that deal specifically with cells, DNA, and genes. So they're, they're biological products. He says, because the SARS-CoV-2 injections were authorized in less than a year from the time that SARS-CoV-2 was identified, these sort of preclinical and clinical processes, regulatory processes, could not be safely carried out. And that, that was clear to anybody. But he goes on to describe how the various stages involved with developing a new medicine require preclinical trials, which can involve very small quantities in a small supply chain. That whole process has to be checked thoroughly. Everything has to be, assessed, every single product involved, each individual process has to be approved. And then when you upgrade that to a slightly larger quantity, then once again, the whole process has to be repeated. So when you multiply the number of the quantities and the number of processes, all of those have to be, the whole thing has to be authorized again from scratch. And then again, when it's scaled up to the sort of large-scale distribution, every product has to be assessed in great detail at each time production is scaled up, because each change can alter the contents of the product and make them toxic. So he goes on. And uses an example of when the blood thinning drug heparin was caused a tragic event where a number of people died after they ingested a product, heparin, that had been contaminated with another product which looked almost identical and was indistinguishable from, you know, when it was when it went through a standard test. So it was completely indistinguishable, but in the manufacturing process, a synthetic product adulterated the product, which led to I can't find how many people died from that incident, but anyways, it was withdrawn from US companies and all around the world. The product was withdrawn, and so the actual the title of a report in 2012 said, was called Heparin, a Wake-Up Call on Risks to the US Drug Supply. These things happen, you know, it's not rare. These things happen quite a lot when you don't have full control over the process. He gives a graph based on the way that drugs are developed, and it shows that, you know, for instance, you have some 10,000 compounds which you submit for a new drug. This is in the first stage of a drug production. It's in the drug discovery stage. You begin with, let's say, 10,000 compounds or molecules which you intend to use. After some 3.5 years, that will be reduced dramatically to about 250, which are selected as candidates suitable for preclinical development. Those then go through preclinical development, and of those, in general, you know, 245. So, you know, the vast majority of them fail safety regulatory requirements, which leads to only 5 being permitted to be used in a clinical trial, and of those, 1 is approved for market. So that's the routine process of drug manufacturing and new drug development, and none of this happened. None of the products in any of these injections were tested individually. So polyglycol 80, you know, has never been used, and has never been injected, I believe, it's never been tested on a living being. Neither have the nanolipid particles. And so the whole thing is just a complete scam. It's incredible. Incredible.
Well, look, I mean, I just want to chip in for a minute, because quite a lot of what we're seeing now is, it's almost like the sort of boiling frogs business of the fact that the government regulation, literally over the last, well, I suppose it's 15 years since 2008, particularly. I mean, the 2008 bailouts were really bail-ins for the banks, and meant that much of what government was doing was shifted from public services onto servicing debt. And the interest rates aren't massive, but you know, the debt is increasing enormously because they're quite small. But anyway, the point being that, I mean, we just here sitting in Bristol have noticed an enormous cutback in the services that the government's providing, and you know, there's been this sort of bonfire of regulations since 2010 as well. So whilst most of us have grown up in a pre-2010 world where the government did actually regulate things, and there were checks and balances, even if they were a bit weak. Usually what was needed was, if there was something which was a bit of a scandal, something going wrong, the press, a press outrage would then kick that rather creaky regulatory machinery into action. Now, since 2008, that regulatory machinery isn't really there. And also we've seen a particularly appalling press that just is not prepared to stand up to anything. I mean, whether it's lawyers or just editors getting rid of good investigative journalists, that both of those two, the regulation and the press, have broken down. So we think we're working in the regulatory environment that we grew up in, but actually what's happened is now a free-for-all.
Exactly, the regulatory capture is a huge issue, and the lack of investigative journalism is another. But let me just conclude on, I mean, this document is several pages long, and it's possible, potentially, that this document, you know, can really sway some MPs, perhaps, if it's forwarded on to MPs and other people, to, you know, because this is a technical document from a professional who works in the field, and so there's no conspiracy about it. There's nothing to suggest a whiff of conspiracy. It's just exposing and scrutinizing processes that should have been well understood and scrutinized by professionals a year ago. He concludes in his document that the development and manufacture of these vaccines has created a supply chain that involves a huge number of actors working in a heavily regulated global environment. Also, it should be noted that GMDP, that is, I think that stands for Global Manufacturing and Distribution. Oh, no, it's good. GMDP stands for Good Manufacturing and Distribution Processes, has been progressively tightened over several decades to protect patients being harmed by errors in the supply chain caused by lack of proper processes and procedures. The risks of undue haste to move materials and products through the end-to-end supply chain cannot be overstated. On this basis, I am concluding that the conditional marketing authorization used by MHRA to approve SARS-CoV-2 vaccines in the UK does not sufficiently protect patients from harm or even death. Furthermore, multiples of injections covering a large percentage of the UK population is still ongoing, and the risk could involve thousands, if not millions, of people. So this is what has been submitted to the law firm as expert report, expert evidence, hopefully, you know, this is going to ruffle some feathers and get the ball rolling a bit further forward. I mean, you know, people like Dr. June Rain, who is the head of MHRA, are going to be taking a lot of flack. I think they're beginning to look incredibly concerned, these individuals who are really in the spotlight. Her and Chris Whitty, they're the fall guys in the UK in some ways, because they should know better. But Chris Whitty in particular, you know, seems to be very much under the influence of Bill Gates. you know, equally Patrick Vallance and this character who's a bit more out of the limelight, but who seems to be even more deeply connected, who's a member of SAGE. Is it Farrah, Jeremy Farrah?
Well, Jeremy Farrah's now resigned from SAGE, I think.
Yes, he did. But he's very intimately connected. In fact, I think, I don't know if anybody's done a deep dive on him, but he's, you know, a very interesting person to go into, I think.
Well, he is. I mean, he was the boss of the Wellcome Trust, who are very much invested in all this research and have been for, well, I think, isn't it, since the 1920s, actually, the Wellcome Trust. As I amazingly discovered in my Is Science Dead interview, well, it was a discussion with Dr. Chris Exley and Chris Busby, that my old grammar school was next door to their main research centre, where actually in the early 1970s, whilst I was at school, Chris Busby was in there working with the Wellcome Trust. It was a little bit mind-blowing, that. But yeah, I mean, he's a perfectly sculpted revolving door guy. I mean, he goes into the industry, he goes into the I think it's probably because these trusts have got this kind of not-for-profit charitable type status, even though they're not officially charities, I don't think. I mean, maybe some of them are, but amazingly, I mean, they seem to be accepted as their aims are for the public good, where actually, really, all they are is a kind of tax dodge where private individuals can finance their own personal peccadilloes or whatever. With him, it's genetic engineering. That's really what the Wellcome Trust was up to.
Genomics, yes. I mean, their whole focus now is on genomics. And of course, this is, as I think I mentioned in an earlier interview, you know, the whole drug industry is moving towards the genomics and biologics side of things, because there's much less, although there should be, I mean, in this document of this expert report from, you know, he states that the regulatory process has been tightened over the years in the distribution and manufacturing stage. But what about in the production stage? And the fact that, you know, I think the one thing that is at the bottom of all this is the fact that biologics and vaccines are immune from liability. And this is the key thing, is the fact.
Yes, basically, they're above the law. You could put it
Right. So if you consider the laborious process, the absolutely the lengthy, costly, laborious process of getting a new drug to market, and then having that new drug actually, you know, make a profit and be a worldwide sort of blockbuster drug, that is a one in a million chance, right? And then you have all these many examples of where the drug has to be recalled, because when it's used on a large scale, it's determined that it's actually more harmful than beneficial. And this has been the story for the last, you know, 50 to 80 years, when, you know, pharmaceutical drugs became more and more prevalent. We've got a handful of standard drugs which are now past their patent use, so that they're now free for everybody to manufacture. And those are the safest and the best drugs available that are routinely used. New drugs are much, much harder to now develop. And so in order to still reap astronomical profits, as they have been doing until now, they're pivoting towards this whole new dimension, which is based on genetics, and that's all a load of crock. but they're going to continue to push it and sell it. And I suspect this whole thing partly was a way to trial these types of new drugs on masses and masses and masses of people, simply because they wouldn't have been able to trial this sort of drug on such a scale in, you know, as they had previously been doing on cancer patients, for example, because, you know, cancer patients traditionally, you know, if they're late stage cancer patients or what have you, then their survival rates are perhaps not so good anyway. Whereas on this sort of scale, you know, you jab millions of healthy people and you watch to see whether it has any effect on their lifespan. And so it's just an absolutely mind-blowing scenario that we were witnessing.
Well, yeah, and also, look, what's happening is the so-called smart money all around the world, as manufacturing starts to falter, you know, as it's controlled by these massive monopolies, no one can get into these markets anymore. And also even service industries the same. Massive amounts of money is coming in to back this whole process, you know, because of it being above the law, above the, you know, no, you know, almost risk free. And so enormous support it's getting pushed unbelievably.
Yeah, and you know, and they're trying to maintain that because it's worked on the SARS-CoV-2 jabs, that they basically won't have to do any of the trials and even the minuscule amount of sort of clinical trials or whatever that they did do. They're claiming they don't have to do any of that for any new drugs they develop, because all they reckon they need to do is just simply change the code. So they're creating these genetic, you know, synthetic genetic sequences and claiming that now all they need to do is just change that sequence and add that into a new vial, a new drug, a new, you know, so there's, it's, yeah, I have no words for how insane
it is. Well, it's a process for standardized human experimentation, basically. Anyway, can you just remind us of the title of this report if anyone wants to find it? I'll put a copy of it or a link or whatever up on our show page. But if people want to find it, if they can't find that and they want to go to it directly, who is the author and what's it called?
Well, it's actually a PhD document. So I'll share it with you on Telegram. It's available on the Robin Minotti and Dr. Mike Eden Telegram channel. It's a document. So there isn't an actual website link to it as yet. I don't know if there will be, but I will
do my best to get it, make sure it's you know, freely available.
Yeah, I'll send you the link to it.
I might get a writ, who knows, from the publisher, who knows. But I mean, I think it's, you know, it sounds to me like life-saving information. I think it's probably a good idea for it to be publicly available.
It is. I mean, Mike Eden says, please share. So,
Sorry, Catherine, can you just give us the author and the title?
Oh, sorry. Well, if you want, but I'll definitely give it to you. It's Headley Expert Report .docs. But the name of the author is Headley Reese, I think. Headley Reese. Yeah, Headley, H-E-D-L-E-Y, Reese. And it's just called Expert Report.
Can you spell that as well? Sorry.
Reese, R-E-E-S.
Okay.
Managing consultant at PharmaFlow.
And has it got a title?
No, it's just a number. It's a massive long number.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, and you also wanted to talk about Taiwan. If you finished on that topic, it'd be good to get your take, because I know you were brought up there, weren't you? This is an island off the coast of China, which at the end of the so-called revolution, at the end of the Second World War, the nationalists, so-called nationalist Chinese, who were fighting the communists, many of them ended up in Taiwan. So it's a separate state.
Well, they fled. Yeah, they fled to Taiwan en masse because they were routed, completely routed by the Communist Party. So some 2 million people escaped to the island of Taiwan and set up government there. Previously, Taiwan had been under the occupation of Japan because in Sino-Japanese War, Taiwan had been ceded to Japan when China lost to Japan. Anyway, I wasn't going to talk about the history of Taiwan, although it's quite fascinating. And of course,
because it's important. I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of people, they just sort of almost assume that communist China has always been there. I was fascinated to discover beginning of last year that actually Yale University took a big part in financing Chairman Mao back in the 1920s and his bookshops, which were the seeds, really, of the communist revolution at the end of the Second World War. So I think these little nuggets help people understand where China has come from.
Yeah, well, I mean, that, you know, I think it's kind of difficult to claim that, oh, well, you know, as some people do, like James Corbett and others, they seem to be claiming that, you know, the West set up the Communist Party, Chinese Communist Party, and bankrolled it, and, you know, China is a complete controlled op of the West. I think that's
I don't agree quite to an, say that, but ridiculous. I think, you know,
yeah.
Yale's role in seeding Mao, you know, and the Communist Party over there is, you know, certainly interesting. Now, you know,
yeah,
it's...
I think that the West was far, far more heavily invested in Sun Yat-sen and the father of the Republic of China. I think, you know, that there were probably some socialist-minded, communist-minded individuals in the West at the time who felt that, yes, you know, that it would be good to spread that sort of thinking, anti-imperial thinking, in places like China. I don't, you know, they weren't the Rockefellers, they weren't the Rothschilds, they weren't the big banking cartels that were financing Chairman Mao, because the last thing they wanted would have been a country that was completely under the control of a state, you know, a state-controlled government and state-controlled country. But yeah, China has not been communist for very long at all. I mean, when you look at the history of China, 5,000 years they claim to have basically unceasingly 5,000 years of unceasing government. Heavenly mandate for the emperors. You know, it has not been communist for very long at all, for all but, what, 80 some years. So Taiwan was sort of a stronghold of the Nationalist Party, who had kind of was set up by Chiang Kai-shek, who was a warlord, basically. He was a drug baron and a warlord, intimately tied to the U.S. State Department, intimately involved, I believe, in the drug triangle in the South China Sea and so on. But he fled with some 2 million supporters onto the island of Taiwan, which until then, as I say, had about... what, 50 years plus of Japanese rule. Prior to that, it had been under Dutch rule. But basically, it was a totally agrarian island. It had predominantly the inhabitants on the island were native Aborigines. They have quite a number of tribes that sort of have a bit of a crossover with other Southeast Asian sort of native tribes in that region. And also a number of immigrants from the Chinese mainland that had come over some 300 years prior. I mean, in the southern provinces of China, in Yunnan province, you know, the sort of, just like the sort of pilgrims that went to the US, you know, from the UK and Europe, these people wanted to live freely. They didn't want to live under the tyranny of an empirical system. And so some 300, 350 years ago, people left South China and went and you know, set up sort of basic farming communities on the island of Taiwan. And they kind of lived side by side with the native Aborigines until the, more or less until these 2 million nationalists from China fled from the communist civil war and set up shop in Taiwan. And from that point onward, Taiwan became sort of under the control of the Nationalist Party. It was very brutal in the early years. They basically banned the South Chinese dialect, the language which is known as Minnan Hua, or Minnan dialect in the South China region, which was what they spoke in Taiwan. They banned that and insisted everyone spoke Mandarin Chinese, which is a Beijing dialect. And all the native Aborigines were more or less forced into the mountains. Taiwan has a central, very mountainous region, which is like a spine, goes all the way down the length of the country. And so when I was growing up there, we used to refer to the native Aborigines as mountain people because we didn't even realize that previously they'd lived on the land and had been forced into the mountains by these nationalist gangs. But anyways, Taiwan has gradually developed over the years. They shook off military dictatorship by the nationalist one-party state. And, you know, they are now in some ways a sort of very vibrant two-party system, vibrant democracy. It is still very much under the influence of the US, but it has this kind of mix of cultural heritage from Japan, from previously from Europe, from the Dutch, although that's very vague, there's not much of that left, but also of the native Aboriginal cultures. And it's just a very interesting place, really. And I would say not quite as corrupt, pharmaceutically speaking, or medically speaking, as, say, the UK and the US are. So I've been keeping a check on, you know, the way Taiwan has handled this whole COVID thing. And of course, in the beginning, everybody was claiming that Taiwan was, you know, a great example of how to do it. They apparently sussed that something was going on in Wuhan, China, before everybody else, because they, you know, they watch what goes on in Chinese social media. And there was a lot of murmurings on Chinese social media, rumors and so on, about stuff that was going on in Wuhan. So immediately in Taiwan, they sort of their ears pricked up and they started to take it seriously. They even warned the World Health Organization before China announced that something was going on. They warned that something was going on in China. Now, like I said last week, I don't know if that was sort of nefarious, whether somebody was seeded, somebody was in position in order to flag this sort of thing up, deliberately fan the flames of panic and make something into something that it wasn't. However, that's what's publicly available, is that Taiwan did try to flag this Wuhan business up to the World Health Organization. They also immediately shut borders to China. They stopped allowing Chinese nationals into Taiwan. And they started testing everybody at the borders with temperature checks and so on, and imposing quarantines on Taiwanese nationals who were returning, and basically banning anybody else from entering the country. So that's what they did initially. And however, they didn't lock down or anything. They had a brief period where schools were shut, but that didn't last very long. There were no mask mandates, although a lot of people did voluntarily wear masks. But we know that masks just don't work. There's no science behind that at all. However, they lived a very normal life. So for the whole period that, you know, the rest of the world, well, I say the rest of the world, I mean Europe, UK and US and Canada, the whole time we were locked down at the beginning of this whole thing in March, April, May 2020, Taiwan didn't lock down at all. So, you know, Taiwan's a very crowded place, very busy. People rub cheek and jowl, you know, shoulder to shoulder. And there was no lockdown. And they carried on in this vein for 18 months. And they had no more than 10 deaths. I think, in fact, they had perhaps only about 4 deaths. So until the 20th of May, 2021, so that's a full 15 months into this whole thing, they had 4 deaths, 4 COVID deaths. They began vaccinating people in mid-April 2021. So they were quite late to the game. Okay, everybody else started in December and January of 2021. They began in April 2021, mid-April. As soon as they started, and they started with AstraZeneca, that was the first vaccine that they accepted into the country, the first manufacturer. As soon as they began, cases started to climb. There were no cases in Taiwan before this. They'd got it down to 0. But as soon as they began the injection process, by the 22nd of May, they had registered 3,862 new cases, and they had 17 deaths. 17 COVID-associated deaths. That's 4 times as many as they'd had in the prior 15 months. Just quite something. By the 22nd of May, they jabbed approximately 300,000 people. So to have 3,800 cases, you know, I just played around with the figures. That's a 1.28 infection rate, if you like. I mean, I don't know if that means anything at all. And then by 25th of October, so that's, 5 months later, they now had 16,376 cases. So that's basically, what, 5-6 months after vaccinations began, they now had astronomical numbers of cases compared to what they had previously. Guess how many deaths they had? COVID deaths. Not 4, not 20, not 50, not 100. They had 847 COVID deaths in just 5 months after vaccination began, when previously they had 4.
I mean, you could look upon this as a consequence, possibly, of this initial policy of keeping COVID out completely of the country, because that, for example, the Swedish would argue that that actually makes you more vulnerable in the future.
But they were still keeping people out. They were still stopping people at the borders and quarantining them. So there was no change. I mean, they're still not allowed out. This is the extraordinary thing, you know. They claimed, so that the official narrative is that was the Delta strain. But my, you know, if you're just looking very sort of objectively at these stats, it looks like the jabs induced this sort of reaction. But not only did they have increased numbers, massively increased numbers of people who died with COVID, they also have a VAERS or yellow card system. And on that, they have now registered over 1,250 deaths from the jabs. And AstraZeneca were the leading cause because they were the ones that have been given the most. And I think the next after that was Pfizer. But they've had a total of 16,000 adverse reactions, close to 7,000 of those are serious, and over 1,000 and a quarter are dead. And that's, you know, direct results. So more people, far, far, far more people have died from the jabs since the jabbing began than the full 15 months prior, when people were just milling about, living their lives, you know, with normally, with no sort of major restrictions in place. It's quite astonishing. I mean, nobody seems to be sort of focusing on this, and they might even claim, I think absurdly they claim, that their adverse reactions and so on are far fewer than the rest of the world. But I mean, the stats don't look good for them at all.
No, so what should they do now, do you think?
Well, you know, my view, along with many other, I'm not an expert, but my personal view and other experts' views, like Mike Eden's, is just to stop everything. Stop testing, stop jabbing, get back to normal. There would be nobody would notice anything. Seriously, there would be nothing noticeable at all if they stopped talking about COVID in the news, about deaths, about cases, about any of that. If they stopped talking about that and stopped testing, literally nobody would know it was there. That's exactly what happened after SARS-CoV-1. That's exactly what they did. And this is what Dr. Wolfgang Wodarg said. As soon as they stopped talking about cases, it vanished. It vanished off the face of the earth. Because it was a completely media-driven thing. It was a completely propagandist thing.
Amazing. Anyway, look, Catherine Gunn, thanks ever so much for joining us again.
Thank you.